good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you are in the world and what time it is when you're tuning in. This is Perrin Desports, and I'm your host for the Group Practice Accelerator podcast from Polaris Healthcare Partners. If you're an entrepreneurial dentist or physician, and you're interested in building a successful group practice, you found your primary resource for some of the industry's best business education. My partner, DeWalker Sinha, and I have decades of experience helping people just like you launch, scale, and ultimately exit successful group practices. In short, we create clarity, confidence, and results. Welcome, everybody, to yet another episode of the Group Practice Accelerator podcast. This is going to be a fast-paced one. I have been wanting to have this gentleman behind the microphone with me for quite a while, and he's kind of busy. His name is Bart Walker. He's a partner at McGuire Woods, an international law firm and a specialist in the M&A world. This is going to be a great discussion. We're going to talk M&A trends coming out of last year, going into this year. Bart does a lot of work with the buy side and enterprise level platforms. He's got a ton of insight to share, and I can't wait to have him on with me today. So stick around, get your pad and pen ready. You know it'll be a note-taking episode. The Group Practice Accelerator podcast is on the air. Well, welcome everybody once again to the Group Practice Accelerator podcast. I am your host, Perrin Desports. And as I teased in the introduction, I've got Bart Walker, partner at McGuire Woods and close friend of mine and DeWalker's, more importantly, to join me on the show today. Bart's a busy guy and we appreciate a little bit of his time. Bart, good to have you back on the show. It's been a little while.
Thanks, Perrin. Yeah, appreciate you having me and looking forward to this first podcast with you guys. I've been wanting to do this for a while and appreciate the invite.
Yeah, you got it. You don't have any trouble filling an 8-hour work day. You're a man who's in constant demand and we really appreciate the time. So let's dive right into this. McGuire Woods is an international firm. Y'all probably do everything as it relates to the law, but your area of focus is in healthcare and predominantly M&A transactions. You do a lot of work with the enterprise level groups, a lot of private equity. I'm hoping you can take just a quick second, since I've wanted to have you on the show for a number of months now, and let's maybe just recap a little bit of what y'all saw at the top end of the food chain, maybe comparing and contrasting 2022 versus the way 2023 ended, and then we can dive into 2024 as well.
Yeah, you bet. And as you said, I spend probably 80-90% of my time doing M&A, 100% of it's in the healthcare services space, and with a strong concentration of that in dental as well. Most of my time is spent either representing private equity funds or other financial sponsors or the bigger kind of DSO platform entities on their acquisition strategies. Also represent a good number of sellers and founder-owned businesses in partnering with M&A. And within the firm, I'm one of the co-chairs of our healthcare industry team. So I have pretty good insights into the other nooks and crannies of healthcare, even where I'm not working on a day-to-day basis. But to recap, I think 2022, I think everybody would agree, was just a record year. It was just off the charts in terms of deal level, activity level, just a really exceptional year, and quite frankly, had a hard time finding enough bodies to just throw at the deals. 2023 was much choppier. There were still opportunities. I know a lot of people like us still had really good years, but it was definitely a more turbulent environment. You definitely had the whole interest rate hikes kind of looming in the background, causing some turbulence, debt market uncertainty, global unrest. It's just a whole host of issues in 23 that we didn't see in 22. 24 already is off to a good start. It's been ramping relatively slowly, but it's definitely ramping. We started to see towards the end of last year, new deal processes kicking off. We've already seen that in the first quarter. We had a number of closings. And if you just look at the industry-wide data, M&A across the board, particularly in healthcare services, is generally up. Some of that's coming from distressed deals, but a lot of it's just the traditional leverage buyouts and M&A activity. So I'd say overall, 2024, cautiously optimistic. It being an election year, there's always some level of uncertainty. You don't really know what's coming down the pike, but that's how I'd characterize it. Curious if you agree with that, but that's from our perspective what it looked like.
Yeah, it's been peaks and valleys or troughs and or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's driven by a number of factors from our end, but I would say generally speaking, and we don't do nearly the deal volume of some other of some other advisors, you know, having the consulting side of the business as well, but we tend to represent some higher value clients too. And I would echo your comments about just general activity. You know, when the credit box shrunk last year for so many of them, it tamped down activity from a unit number standpoint. And then certainly the increase in rates has a dramatic impact on things like valuation, and then sort of separating some of the enterprise groups as the way they go about buying smaller groups and individual practices, just to focus more on clinic level profitability versus those relying on a pure equity as it relates to recap. So I think, you know, this year will be a better year probably in the aggregate, but hopefully that's a harbinger of, you know, even better things to come. Let's maybe talk just a little bit, Bart, about some, you know, other trends in 2024 as we're moving into 2024. These probably have tails going back to 23, but, you know, staffing challenges and wage rates are always one. You know, there are a lot of, we call them duct tape DSOs, or like clubbing up or kind of amalgamating something akin to a group practice of friends coming together. I mean, you got not just that, but there's like the buy side of diligence and reps and warrants and all different sorts of stuff. You know, what I know I threw a lot at you, there was sort of a shotgun blast, but maybe if you can take any number of those and dissect them a little bit more for our audience, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah. And there's a lot there. There's plenty to talk about. I think staffing challenges, I think everybody would agree that's it's a problem for clinical staff, for non-clinical staff, any business that relies on employees to grow, which is just about every business out there, but especially when we're talking about healthcare services, especially when we're talking about dental service providers, it's just heavily, heavily human capital business. And it's impossible to scale and grow without a steady pipeline of folks to just heal natural attrition and then growth on top of that. It's a labor intensive enterprise. So that's challenging for sure. And I know we'll be talking separately about the FTC's new final rule about non-competes. You know, will that provide some additional fuel to the fire or things to talk about when it comes to labor and employment? Certainly a lot to think about there. You mentioned kind of clubbing up deals or getting together. That really ranges the gamut. There are some that are put together with duct tape, as you say. Then there are some others that are really well thought out and professionally done, where people, you know, they're looking at the capital markets. They're saying, you know, look, I really don't want to give up equity yet. Debt's relatively expensive. Is there a way to create scale and kind of build a DSO, build an MSO without getting third-party capital involved? I think the answer is maybe. It's going to be hard, but you know, it's possible with the right, you know, advisors and consultants to help you along the way. So we've been seeing more of that, and I think it's because debt's relatively expensive. Not in the global scheme of things when you look back 50 years, but when you look back 10, debt is much more expensive today than it was, you know, 5 years ago, even 3 years ago. So I think that's forcing people to start to ask themselves, you know, can I go it alone for a while longer and bide my time and see where it goes? So we're helping people a lot more with that than we have in the past, but still doing deals, obviously. In terms of M&A and the M&A market, rep and warranty insurance is a very common thing these days. So for the uninitiated, and I'll just try to give a very elementary overview of what rep and warranties are. But when you sign a purchase agreement, there are a bunch of reps and warranties in that purchase agreement, and it's everything you'd want to know about that business. In other words, you know, you own the business, you own the assets, you haven't broken the law, you don't owe any overpayments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's 20 pages of reps that you're giving on the business. Well, you can get an insurance policy against breaching one of those reps. So post-closing, if it turns out one of those reps you gave the buyer isn't correct and you've breached that representation and there's a loss associated with that, you can actually go to an insurance policy that would pay out rather than going back to the seller. And so buyers like it because it smooths the negotiation process under the purchase agreement. Sellers like it because it shifts the risk of loss from them and onto an insurance policy. So that's become much, much, much more common, even in smaller deals. It used to be the case that we'd only see that on deals over, you know, 100 million of enterprise value. But nowadays, the market's really become more egalitarian in the sense that just about any size deal you can get rep and warranty coverage on. And then the last trend I'll talk about just real quickly is just more distressed M&A. There definitely is some distress out there in certain corners of the market, depending on where you are geographically, depending on where you're positioned in the market in terms of reimbursement and revenue. Look, depends on your cost structure, depends on how highly levered the business is. We're definitely seeing some cracks here and there on some of these businesses. So we've been spending quite a bit of time on that front as well.
Yeah, I think that's interesting in that last comment in terms of distressed entities is a, I don't want to say a common refrain, but I feel like I've heard general conversations about that more in the last, I don't know, maybe not 6 to 9 months or something like that than I ever had in the prior 6 to 9 years, you know? And I think some of that is driven by late entrants into the market that just went for max leverage and were shotgun blast about their acquisition strategy, even overpaying for marginal practices and assets, and then not being able to generate any clinic level improvement in them. And when the debt markets course correct as quickly as they did, that catches a lot of those aggregators out. And I think I don't think either one of us are saying that that's the majority of the industry. It obviously is not. But sometimes when those types of bigger boats hit rocky shores, it tends to reverberate through the industry. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing, Bart, because it brings people back to the core discipline around M&A and improving the business after you've acquired it, and all the, I hate to say, just unsexy fundamentals that should drive the M&A markets. But sometimes when lending rates are really low and credit is available anywhere and everywhere, people lose the discipline of what the core business should be. So probably getting a good bit of that right now. Let's talk maybe a little bit about what you see and sort of what you're sensing either empirically or gut level for 2024, and maybe Bart Walker's crystal ball as it relates to 2025. What's top of mind? What are you sensing? What are your thoughts there, Bart?
Yeah, I think this year will continue to ramp in terms of M&A activity. We're definitely seeing signs of strengthening in the credit markets. It seems like rates are stabilizing. Those are now being baked into the expectations on both the buyer and seller side. So I'm cautiously optimistic about 24. 25 is largely going to be a function of the election, I'm afraid. I think either way is going to create opportunities, but different opportunities. I think, and it's hard to talk about this without also talking about some of the regulatory and policy decisions that go along with it. First and foremost, the FTC's rule on non-competes, the FTC antitrust positioning and really focusing on the healthcare industry from a consolidation perspective, that has definitely put a damper on enthusiasm for healthcare roll-ups and consolidation strategies. You know, certainly still viable, certainly still tons of opportunity there, but we've not really seen an FTC this antagonistic to that sector historically. So will be interesting to see how that plays out. Of course, if we have a second Trump presidency, then I think that changes quite a bit. That changes the outlook on how FTC views the healthcare world and just the world in general. So 2025, I think, will be a function of that. I'm not sure how that's going to shake out. I really don't have a prediction on that. But from a macro level, it does seem like things are trending upwards and in the right direction. Whether that continues or not remains to be seen.
Yeah, very, very well said. And let's hold some dry powder for maybe a second podcast episode with Bart Walker to talk about that very FTC ruling. Maybe we'll dive into that for the next one coming up. I kind of think we will. Bart, this is really good information, though, on the state of M&A. You know, we don't get to spend nearly enough time with you, and I'm really grateful for you being so generous and sharing some of your wisdom and your time with us today. And I'd love to do this more often as it relates to M&A and everything else. And thank you for being a friend of the show, friend of the company, and being willing to hop on this episode with me today for sure. Bart Walker, partner at McGuire Woods. Thanks for being with me, buddy.
Thanks, Baron. Yeah, really appreciate the opportunity. Happy to talk anytime.
You got it. Stick around for some additional thoughts and I'll wrap up the show. And welcome back to the show. Sincere thanks to Bart Walker, partner at McGuire Woods, for joining me on the show today. He's a wealth of knowledge in addition to the fact that he's just a great guy and easy to talk to. And he is absolutely, his time is absolutely in demand. So the fact that I got the better part of an hour with him today on two different episodes of the podcast that you will hear the next one next week is really a testament to his kindness and generosity. He's somebody that I really don't get to spend nearly enough time with and would love to have him on the show more often and even would like just to grab coffee with him more often. Super good guy, and I'm very grateful to him for a little bit of time today and sharing his wisdom and knowledge. As we conclude today's show, and we're on this maybe awkward transition of wisdom and knowledge, I wanted to talk a little bit about a thinking tool, if you will. You know, for those of you who've been in our podcast audience, maybe even going back to the prior company for 5 or 6 years now, we talk a lot about, you know, metrics and trends and the industry and being operators and all that. And you know, there's a lot of merit in that, obviously. I think you all derive a lot of value out of it. We get a lot of nice compliments and feedback via email or text or when I see people out on the road when I'm speaking and things like that. But I think one of the areas that we don't really spend as much time on is conceptual and really more thinking tools and their applications. I'm starting to do a lot more of this in both the Catalyst Project, a 6-week multi-practice accelerator course that I teach, as well as the Ascendant Executive. I haven't talked a lot about Ascendant Executive yet, but you'll hear more about it in the coming weeks and months. But both of these are group coaching models, Catalyst being 6 week, Ascendant Executive being 4 quarters or 4 quadrants, if you will. But all of them are taught over Zoom. And it's me with a handful of participants or students in live fire where I get to teach a concept or a tool or something on one evening of the week. And then we come back on the Friday of that same week and dig deeper into it and really bat around a lot of Q&A. It's been very much fun for me, honestly, a little bit of a departure from consulting and a lot of the work that I've done up to this point. But I think it's been very impactful for the participants up to this point, too. And we've gotten a lot of really good feedback from it. And I preface this by saying that because I think it's a little bit of a departure in terms of not just what I share, but how I share it and the way that you apply it. And when we come back to thinking tools, one of the ones that I fall back on a lot that I'd like to share with you that you can start to apply on your own is something called a quadrant model. And a quadrant model is pretty well known in the world of strategic planning and MBA world and things like that. But I find that it's not used nearly as much in the entrepreneurial world, or maybe that's just the entrepreneurial healthcare world. And the quadrant model is simply, if you take a sheet of paper and you draw, you know, a vertical line and a horizontal line that bisects it, you've got four equal quadrants from left to right. And for any of you who've read the book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, for those who haven't read it, it should be mandatory reading for all of you. It's a book that I go back and reread every couple of years, and I've dog-eared more pages highlighted and scribbled in the margins than I'd care to admit. But it's probably one of the best books I've ever read. And every time I go back to it, even though it's somewhat fundamental in nature, it's always a great refresh. So Seven Habits by Stephen Covey, C-O-V-E-Y, is a book that everybody should read and reread. Covey talks about, in his quadrant model, trying to avoid getting caught up in what he calls the thick of thin things. And you've heard me use that phrase several times, probably on the podcast. Specifically, the quadrant model that he built is a model that compares and contrasts urgent versus important. This is also known as the Eisenhower matrix. It is something that Covey popularized because probably none of us were around in Dwight Eisenhower's storied military career or during his presidency. And when he became president of the United States, he developed and used something called the Eisenhower matrix to help him save time and make decisions. And it's the urgent versus important. So you have four boxes. And on the left-hand side, the top one is urgent. The bottom one is not urgent. Across the top, there's important and not important. And when you combine those two terms into each box, you get one, the first box that's urgent and important, urgent and not important to the right, and then on the bottom, not urgent but important, and not urgent and not important. This is a simplistic way of breaking down a lot of the way you think about what you do in terms of task, and maybe more importantly, where you spend your time and where you waste your time. And when you start mapping out activity levels as it relates to everything you get caught up in, you start to bifurcate a lot of it into these different quadrant applications. A lot of things that you do that are urgent and important are things you cannot delegate. You've got to do them, and maybe you're the only one who can do them. There are a lot of other things, though, that are very important, but they're not urgent. And these are the ones, like strategic planning, that typically move the business ahead multiple years at a time. Yet, because they're not urgent, we don't spend nearly enough time with them. A quadrant model forces you to look at things differently and get uncomfortable with where your time goes, and makes you question whether or not you're making maximum impact in your business. I use quadrant models a lot. It is a systematic way of thinking about things. And sometimes putting it in paper in front of you forces you to confront facts, not just your gut level assessment or what you're feeling in that given period of time. So urgent and important being a quadrant model. For those of you who have heard the name Steve Jobs, probably we all have, right? And most of you, if you follow Apple or Steve Jobs, you know they're that Apple's head of design and one of the key people that Jobs tapped early on in his return to Apple is a guy named Johnny Ive. Johnny Ive is probably very well known because he's the kind of aesthetic designer. He's the artist, if you will, behind a lot of the Apple products. And when I say artist, I mean like aesthetically, the way they operate, the way they look, the way they feel, the way they kind of draw us all in. He's the head of creative, head of creativity or whatever. I don't know what his title is, but he was Jobs's right-hand guy. And when Jobs returned to Apple, the company was kind of in a shambles. It was running out of cash, had really been run into the ground, wasn't performing well from a stock price standpoint or an operational profitability standpoint. And Steve Jobs really had a dramatic turnaround to get going and get going really, really quickly. And one of the first things he did when he came back to Apple was look at their product lineup. All the different products that Apple was developing at the time and marketing and selling, and they just had way too much stuff going on. And Jobs sat down with Johnny Ive and drew out a quadrant model and basically looked at him and said, Johnny, here's the way I want you to evaluate things. Individual versus organizational and laptop versus desktop. Individual versus organizational, meaning is this to be used by an individual or is this something we want to sell into a company and organization-wide type of a scenario? And is it a laptop or is it a desktop type media or application? This quickly allowed them to cut the things that were not products that were really maximizing Apple's core competence. And it got the company to focus on a limited number of products very quickly, products they could be the best at, compete and win in the marketplace, and ultimately generate more revenue and profitability to save the company. All right. So this is I don't know how many of you know this story or not about Apple. That's why I'm sharing it. But it's an illustration of the way something so simplistic as a quadrant model can be applied to most any business for substantial effect. For those who work with us in a consulting relationship, or maybe have seen a few of the presentations I've given from the stage, we talk about the Polaris scalability matrix, which is a quadrant model. It sort of compares and contrasts EBITDA margin, that's percentages, versus what we call utilization rate. Most of you know that that's measured in a per chair per hour basis. And it allows us to assess the overall effectiveness and the viability of a client we're working with in terms of their ability to generate and maximize revenue from a utilization standpoint, to take the greatest level of advantage from the capacity of the business, the days and the hours. Are they generating maximum revenue per chair per hour? And if they are doing that, are they also doing it in a way that maximizes marginal profitability or EBITDA? And for those that do, or who are able to do both, then we know this is a high performing business we're about to work with. For those that struggle with either of those, it gives us a lot of clarity on what we need to focus on first. So a couple of different applications for this type of a quadrant model in terms of the way we think about it, or a matrix, if you will, some of its time and impact around the way you use your time as an executive. Again, urgent versus important. Some of it could be a product-related application in the Apple case, and some of it could be assessing the overall profitability and revenue generation potential of the core business at hand. The reason I wanted to share these, though, is because those of you who are building businesses, who are either in the emerging group space, like many of you are in that Catalyst project or the Ascendant Executive, are starting to think about your businesses differently as you start to add additional locations. Those that are in the Catalyst project and in the Ascendant Executive are not staring down an exit anytime soon. These are the early stage entrepreneurs that are excited about the journey, are looking to learn new business principles, applications, and how to build a business the right way and aren't necessarily in any hurry to do it. They're a really, really fun group to work with, I'm going to be honest with you. And these are some of the thinking tools that we share in those types of applications. And then for those who've worked with us in a consulting capacity, you've probably seen some of these in full application as it relates to your business. So I thought that I'd take a couple of minutes and share that as I wrapped up the show today. Obviously, a significant departure from the first half of the podcast with Bart Walker, but something worth sharing. And if you've got questions about either Catalyst or Ascendant Executive, and would like to send me an email, you can do that, Perrin@PolarisHealthcarePartners.com. There's some information on the website about it, PolarisHealthcarePartners.com there. The Catalyst class is closed right now, and the next one will be in August, if I remember correctly. That's the six-week course. The Ascendant Executive, we are in quarter two, and if you'd like to join us in the next phase of that journey, you can do so. The next entrance point for Ascendant Executive is the week after 4th of July, if I remember correctly. So happy to answer any questions about any of that, and would love to have you in either one of those courses in the next upcoming session. Thanks so much for being a listener and a subscriber. We'll see you on the next episode.